One of the sad realities of life in this world is evident when we read reports in the newspaper of some crimes that take place in our land. I'm particularly thinking of serious sexual crimes against young children. It seems when the story comes out as the court proceedings take place that the perpetrators of these crimes often seem to follow the same pattern. They've been caught having committed some heinous crime that is repulsive to the vast majority of people in our society. But that isn't just a one-off thing that has taken place. They may have committed the same crime a number of times. But before the crime for which they have been arraigned in court takes place, there is a pattern of behaviour that has led there. Perhaps they have begun with thoughts and with dwelling on material that has fed their lust in a particular way. And as that has dominated their lives, so they've become involved in illicit behaviour, which in the end has resulted in the crime that they've committed. James talks about that kind of progression in his letter. In James chapter 1 and verse 14, he says, "Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." It's this same process that James is talking about that we often see reflected in the stories of men who have committed these gross crimes. It all begins, James says, in the mind, in the heart, before ever any action takes place. Now, while that is true of these gross crimes, and indeed of all sin, whatever form it may take, the converse is also true. That good behaviour, that behaviour that is applauded by society, that great acts of benevolence and so forth, they too begin with the mind and affect our affections, our desires, before they come out in actual action. And this is something that the Apostle Paul refers to in his letter to the Romans. In Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2, we read those well-known words, "I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." There's the action. "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." There's the thought process that will lead to that action. He says elsewhere in Romans, "Those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit." So there we see this connection between the way we think, the things that we think about, and our actions. And it's almost inevitable that what we think about will eventually result in action, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And so in Paul's letter to the church in Philippi, this church that he planted in one of his missionary journeys and for which he has an enormous affection, Paul writes to this church and he speaks about the mind. He speaks about the affections. He speaks about what will control the actions of these people. And so in verse 8 of Philippians chapter 4, we read, "Brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Paul is concerned that the Philippian church think about things that will lead to right action. It begins with right thinking. And so he presents these eight things. There are six whatevers and two any or anythings. Let's look more closely at these things. Commentators seem to put these into couplets. They put two of these words together, pairing them up. This isn't done in the Greek. There's just this list of words. Whatever is just, noble, true, lovely, and so on. But they do seem to go together in a natural way. The first two words have to do with truth and nobility. Whatever things are true. The word might also be translated, whatever things are honest, whatever things are sure, whatever things are genuine, whatever things are real, what has substance? It has to do with reality. Elsewhere, this word refers to the testimony of someone who is bearing witness. We find it in Peter's first letter, in chapter 5 and verse 12. He writes there, by Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting and testifying. That's this same word, that this is the true grace of God in which you stand. It's a testimony. It's something that Peter is bearing witness to in his letter. In John's Gospel, John writes using the same word in chapter 19 and in verse 35. And we're told there, after one of the soldiers has pierced the side of Christ as he hangs there on the cross, to demonstrate that he is dead, or to find out whether he's dead. We're told in verse 35, he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true. It's the same word that is being used here. His testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. So John, who stood there at the foot of the cross and was observing all these things, he tells us, my testimony, it's true. I've seen it. I observed it with my own eyes. And I'm telling you, I'm reporting these things to you. They are real. This is the genuine truth. This can be held on to as reliable. It's honest. It's sure. You can entrust your life to this testimony. These things, Paul exhorts the Philippian church, these things should be thought about. They should be meditated upon. And he couples this together with the word translated in the New King James, noble. Whatever things are noble. You might have a different translation which may use the word honourable or dignified. It has the sense of something that is reverent or serious, something that is grave. The only other places where this word is used in the New Testament are in Paul's letter to Timothy and to Titus, where he gives the qualifications for deacons and the characteristics of the older men in the church, where he speaks of them as being serious or as being reverent. Again, the theme here is that of something that is to be taken seriously, something that is real. In contrast to the phrase, well, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, Paul is arguing you should take life seriously. You should approach life in a dignified way, in an honorable way, in a reverent way, recognizing that while tomorrow you may die, when you die, you meet the living God, your Creator. And eating, drinking, and making merry is not the way to ensure that you are right with Him. Whatever things are noble, whatever things are going to cause you to think about the seriousness of life and the issues of life and the outcome of life, think about those things. These things are the reality. Everything else is just fluff and sparkle, and it may attract, but it isn't going to prepare you for what is to come. My brethren, think about the things that are true, the things that are noble. Meditate on those things, because what you think about is going to affect the way you live. If you think about truth and nobility in the sense that I've just described, it's going to affect your lives. It's going to affect your actions. It's going to cause you to live in a manner that will prepare you for these ultimate realities that the world thinks so little of. So in that first couplet, Paul is speaking about things that are real. He's speaking about the reality of life. He goes on in the next couplet to speak about morality. He talks about what is just and what is pure. The sense of the word just here in the context that we find it in the New Testament has to do with conforming to God's standard of what is right. We use the word righteous for that, don't we? It's what is right. It's what is upright. That is just. We find this word expressed throughout the New Testament, but only in the odd place. In two of John's writings, in John's Gospel, we find it in chapter 5 and in verse 30. There Jesus says, I cannot myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. When he talks about his judgment being righteous, he's saying it's just. My judgment is just. I'm not doing my own thing, and he's referring them to God. I am doing what my Father wants me to do. I'm doing his will, the will of the Holy God, the one who is righteous and just in all his ways. And then again, John writes in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 12. And there he says, this is the message that I heard from the beginning, that you should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous. That word righteous there is the same word that Paul uses in this letter to the Philippians, the word just. What he's saying there is Cain's actions were contrary to God's standards, while Abel's actions were consistent with God's standards. Cain's actions were evil, his brother's actions were just. That's what Paul wants us to think about. He wants us to think about God's standards of right and wrong, of acceptable living and unacceptable living. It doesn't matter what the world's standards are. That won't count for anything when you stand before the judgment seat of God. It is God's standards that will be the benchmark for our living, against which he will examine us, and upon which we will have to give an account and accept his just judgment. We may seek to argue, well, but those were the acceptable norms for the society in which I lived. That may be true, but they're not acceptable norms for God. They were not the acceptable norms of creation when it was first made and when God pronounced it all very good. It's the acceptable norms of a corrupt world, a sin-infested world, a depraved world in which everyone does what is right in his own eyes, in which the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, in which everyone has gone astray like sheep. Paul calls these Philippian Christians to think about what is just, to think about what conforms to God's standard of morality. And connected with that, he says, think about what is pure. Meditate upon those things. What is holy? What is chaste? What is without blemish and without defect? Coupled with this is the idea of innocence also. Someone who hasn't the knowledge of evil, doesn't know about the awful atrocities that go on in the world. An innocent person, someone whose mind is pure. This is the idea that we have here. And again, we can look at the use of this word elsewhere, and we find in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 12, in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, Paul uses this word and he says, I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. Christ doesn't want second-hand goods. He wants something unused, something pure, something chaste, like a virgin who has never known a man. This is how Paul wants to present the Corinthian church to Christ. And this is the same word then that he's using in writing to the Philippians, that they are to be pure, to be chaste, without blemish, without spot, not used in any way. And again, John writes using this word in his first letter, in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3. Following on from that well-known passage where he talks about the love of God to us. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God. In verse 3 he says, everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. The hope of glory. The hope of one day being with God and being seeing him as he is and being like him. If we have that hope, then we purify ourselves. We cleanse ourselves just as he is pure. It's the same word, just as he is pure. We're to think about this degree of purity that is absolute perfection. And that is what we are to strive towards, Paul says as he writes to the Philippians. My brethren, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, meditate on those things. If you want to live a life that is pleasing to God, if you want to live a life that is morally upright, don't compare yourselves with the world's standards. Don't think about what the world finds acceptable. It is to God that you must give an account. It is God who will require an answer for the way that you have lived. And so Paul calls this church to think about morality in terms of just what is just and what is pure, because the way they think, the things they think about, will have an outflow in their behavior. They think pure thoughts, they think about what is just, what is acceptable to God, then that is much more likely to work out in a life of justice and purity than allowing one's thoughts to dwell on what is impure and standards that are unjust. And then he goes on in a third couplet, speaking about whatever things are lovely and whatever things are of good report. And these two words are tied together by the impact that they have upon other people. These two words are both only used in this verse in the entire New Testament. So it's more difficult for us to compare it and to see exactly what Paul had in mind in these words. The term lovely has the idea of something that is pleasing or agreeable, something that is attractive or desirable, something that you see and you think, I would like to have that. That's a pleasing thing. That's an attractive thing. The next term that in the New King James is translated good report may also be translated praiseworthy or commendable. Literally, it can be translated well sounding, having a good ring to it. And so what we have in these two words is what we see with our eyes and what we hear with our ears. We're to think about things that are lovely and are attractive, that are well sounding to us. But not just to us, things which are attractive and commendable to God. Things that are real, things that are moral, and things that have the effect of drawing us closer to God. That is what Paul is calling these Philippians to meditate upon. Whatever meets those categories, fits into those descriptions, think about those things. And then there's a fourth couplet there, using the word any or anything. If there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. And this is kind of summarizing what he's already written in the previous three couplets. Virtue has to do with moral excellence. Peter uses this term in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. There he writes, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That word praises there is the word excellencies, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. It's the same word that is used here and translated virtue, excellency, something that is praiseworthy once again. And then the next phrase that uses that word I've just used, praiseworthy, has to do with something that is commendable, something that receives approval. And in Romans chapter 2, this word is used by the Apostle Paul, chapter 2 and verse 29. I'll start from verse 28. He is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. And again, this word praise is the same word that Paul is using in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. It's something that is commended by God. It's something that is approved by God. Here were people who were arguing that if you wanted to be approved by God, accepted by God, commended by God, you had to fulfill the old Mosaic laws. And Paul is saying, that's not the case at all. That those rituals were there and were intended to present a picture of something more real and more enduring that would be truly commendable to God. Even the Old Testament, even the book of Deuteronomy, talks about the need to have our hearts circumcised, to be made pure within, to have sin eradicated from us. Only that will be praised by God. Only that is commendable to God and approved by Him. And so these terms that Paul has used here are summed up in these two words, virtue and praiseworthy. This is God's statement. He will praise you. He will commend you if your life is lived according to these standards. And your life will only be lived according to these standards if these things occupy your thoughts. There is no way that your life is going to be pure, that your life is going to be commended by God if your thoughts are filled with thoughts of lust and sin and greed and envy and discontent. It's never going to happen, because the way you think will be the way you live. And it doesn't surprise us, therefore, that when Paul writes these words to the Philippian church, after saying, meditate on these things, he then talks about other things, or in fact, the same things, but in a different form. In verse 9, the things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. Paul has begun by saying, I want you to think about these things. Whatever is true, noble, just, pure, lovely, of good report, anything of virtue, anything praiseworthy, think about these things. And then verse 9 he says, in effect, do these things. Act upon these things. What things? Well, the things that they're to think about that they have seen evidenced in Paul's own life. Meditate on these things and look how I've applied these things in my life, Paul is saying. After all, Paul's concern for the Philippian church isn't about them thinking the right thoughts only, but living the right life. As we said earlier on in our series, verse 27 basically summarizes the goal of Paul's letter. Let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ. That's what he wants of the Philippian church. And that's what verse 8 is supposed to draw out of them. Conduct worthy of the gospel of Christ. And so he calls on them to view his conduct. And he says, don't just listen to the words that I speak, but look at my life. He's already said the same thing, hasn't he? Brethren, chapter 3, verse 17, join in following my example and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. In 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, he takes that a step further and he says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. He's only interested in this Philippian church copying what he does insofar as he has been faithful in copying what Christ does. And so he calls on them. The things you learned, the things you learned about me from others, do those things. The things which you received by my hand in letters and instructions that have come to you, these things do. The things that you have heard from my mouth as I spent time in your presence and preached the gospel of Jesus Christ, these things do. And the things that you have observed, that you have seen in my life as I've lived it out before you, these things do. And the God of peace will be with you. Ultimately, Paul is calling these people to observe the power of Christ at work in his life, that they may see that same power working out in their lives as they think about these things. After all, he's already said, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ." Paul isn't interested in making clones of himself. Paul wants men and women who have been conformed to the image of Christ. That is God's purpose in salvation, that we should be made like our brother, Jesus Christ, the Saviour. And so we must think like him, and so we must act like him. And all these things that are described by Paul here are really a description of Christ, are they not? We've observed in the example texts that we've looked at how closely they tie into the character of God and the life of Christ. Think about reality, ultimate reality. And what do you end up thinking about? You think about Christ, the truth of his life, of his death, of his sacrifice for sin, of his resurrection, of his ascension into heaven, of his coming again to judge the world. It's true. It's real. It's genuine. It's sure. And it's serious. It's grave. These are issues that we must not play with. We must not gamble our lives away thinking that these things are neither here nor there. This is reality. It is wrapped up in the person and work of Jesus Christ. Think about that. The same can be said for morality. That is seen in its perfection in Jesus Christ. The one who conformed himself to God's standard as no other human being ever did. The one man and the one woman who had the benefit of not being born in sin fell into sin. Not to follow them and their example of selfishness and greed. To follow the example of Jesus Christ, who conformed himself to God's standard despite all the opposition that a fallen world could throw against him. He stood firm to the end, and he was pure in every aspect of life. Even his enemies had to raise up trumped up charges against him in order to get their way and have him executed. No one could point a finger against him. He was pure, without a blemish. You want to see true morality? Look at the life of Jesus Christ. And when you look at Christ and his life, what is more lovely? What is more well-sounding than a description of the works of Christ and the character of Christ? He is the most desirable of men. and his life is a life which is full of praiseworthy deeds. And so there is none who has more excellence and is more worthy of praise than Jesus Christ. He is the perfection of all these things that Paul describes for us in this letter. If we want to see how we ought to live, examine the life of Christ. By thinking about Christ's attributes, we will be equipped to conform, model our lives on Christ's character. If we don't think about Christ, we're never going to be made like Christ. If he doesn't occupy the thoughts of our hearts day and night, then other things will come in, and they will occupy those thoughts, and they will affect our lives. The psalmist cried out in Psalm 34, verse 8, "Come, taste and see that the Lord is good." Eve stretched out her hand and took fruit on the tree. It looked good. It tasted good. But it was rotten to the core. But the psalmist found something that was truly good. Something that you can dig your teeth into and be satisfied. "Blessed is the man who trusts in him," he goes on to say. And those of you here this morning who have tasted, have seen that the Lord is good. But perhaps you've forgotten. And perhaps you need to be called back. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. These things do. Everything else is rubbish. Perhaps you've never tasted, you've never tried, you've never really looked, you never really considered the virtues of the Lord Jesus Christ and the transforming power that he can bring to bear upon your life. And I urge you this morning, come to Jesus Christ, come and taste and see if these things are not so.